Why do we exist? Were we created with a purpose? Or are we just here by chance? What are we to believe about life, faith, and worldview? Welcome to The Universe Next Door, focusing on answers to the questions we all consider. The Universe Next Door is supported by the C.S. Lewis Society, Trinity College of Florida, and supported by gifts from listeners just like you. Discover more resources and continue the conversation at apologetics.org. And now, your host, the research professor of Bible and theology at Trinity College of Florida, author and speaker, Dr. Tom Woodward.
Welcome to The Universe Next Door, and thank you for joining us today. Dr. Woodward, we have some very exciting apologetics news to jump into. How are you doing today?
I'm having a great day. I hope you are too, Nick.
Yes, I absolutely am.
Awesome. Well, I am excited today that we are able to feature a lot of breaking news. There's some things that are coming out from the world of genetics, and I think that we're seeing kind of a cultural meltdown around us, but in the midst of that chaos, and it's almost a bit depressing just to look and to see how truth claims are no longer debated in open, free form. But it's like, if you do not conform to my truth dictate, then I will cancel you. Well, we're going to be talking a lot about this problem of cultural chaos and meltdown, but especially the good news that when the opposition to Christian faith and to the claims of Christ, when that opposition speaks out, it's not the end of the process. There is a reply. There is a return to kind of like discussing or debating the point and not just, okay, chop it off, that's the end. And we sometimes call this in the courtroom cross-examination. And so if it's okay with you, Nick, I'd like to go ahead and head into that area of evidence where evidence is hotly debated. It's back and forth, and when the opponent speaks, then we can have, as it were, that Proverbs 18:17 moment and have a cross-examination.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most important passages and concepts in the Bible relating to apologetics, and actually one of my personal favorite apologists, especially for doing live question and answers, is Frank Turek, and that's the name of his ministry, is Cross-Examine.
Wow. Well, I mean, that says it all, because cross-examination is a double entendre. Of course, it has the idea in the courtroom of someone has made a statement, it's been written down and recorded in the record of the trial, but then there's an opportunity for the other side, whether it be the plaintiff or the defendant, to come back and challenge that claim and to show weaknesses or flaws or problems with that claim. And, of course, if I can go ahead and read the Proverbs 18:17 passage, the first to plead his case seems just. In other words, seems to be on the right side of goodness, righteousness, justice, and truth. So let me start that again. The first to plead his case seems just until another comes and examines him. Well, if that's not cross-examination, I don't know what it is. But again, of course, Frank Turek, that second layer of meaning, which is to examine the cross of Christ. So I just love double meaning phrases like that. It's pretty powerful. So are we ready to jump in?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, well, I want to just mention that the reply to critics of Christian faith and to the claims of Christ, the replies are found throughout the literature, beginning as early as if you go back to the origins of the Christian faith, growing out of the seedbed of Judaism. You find people challenging Jesus all the time, and he has very, very sharp and well-thought-out replies, ready to go, as it were, at a moment's notice. And all through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Jesus is interacting with his critics. He doesn't, you know, scurry away. He doesn't hide from them. As he does his ministry in public, he engages with them and has what I think are rather sharp, strong, effective, critiquers or defeaters for the points that they are making. And, of course, they were accusing him of casting out demons through the power of Beelzebub, you know, the reputed, the nickname given to the prince of demons in the times of the Old Testament. And Jesus said, well, you know, number one, if I'm doing it by Beelzebub, then how are you, the Jewish exorcist, casting out demons? Are they doing it by the same power? And secondly, if Satan is casting out Satan, wouldn't that be the divided kingdom, the ultimate picture of a kingdom that is being torn apart in the interior as they're turning on each other. So Jesus had, you know, some really strong points to make, and then of course his followers, his disciples, the apostles, and others. We're able to critique some of these claims that Jesus was not raised from the dead. And I love dealing with those, but I'm going to go fast forward, leap back up to our day. And I'm just holding in my hand Bertrand Russell's book, a famous book from the middle of the 20th century, Why I Am Not a Christian. And Nick, you may have heard of Bertrand Russell, the British philosopher.
Yeah, I'm familiar with him.
So let me share a couple things really quickly on Bertrand Russell as it pertains to cross-examination, because he was an outspoken critic, and you may have heard me mention from time to time that there are forerunners to the modern-day Richard Dawkins, this whole phenomenon of atheists who have developed a kind of a career around attacking Christian faith and critiquing it right and left. Well, Bertrand Russell is one of those who wrote a whole series of essays during his life and then published them again as this book, Why I Am Not a Christian. And when you get into the book, it's quite a scattershot effect. I mean, it's kind of a mixed bag. But one of the main early attacks he makes on Christ is that there is no possibility for Christ to be truly God in flesh, as the Christians believe, Orthodox, Catholic, or Protestant. All creedal Christians accept that Jesus was fully God and fully man. That's basic to the truth of the New Testament. It's basic to the overwhelmingly clear claims of Christ himself. That was the basis of C.S. Lewis's masterpiece argument entitled The Great Trilemma, the Lord, Liar, Lunatic argument for the deity of Christ. And Bertrand Russell just pushes that to one side, just shoves it over into the category of incredible. He says, because Jesus made a prediction, and that prediction is found in Matthew 16. It's also found in Mark and Luke. And that prediction made at the same time that Peter, of course, said, I know who you are. You are the Messiah. When Jesus asked his disciples, who do men say that I am? And that, as it were, blurted out true answer, the correct answer, Jesus attributed to the Father, revealing it, you know, through supernatural means to Peter. And then he said, you know, follow me, do not hesitate to take up your cross daily and follow me, you know, be willing to die to your old life and to live for the kingdom. And then he says, there are some standing here, and these are the key words that Bertrand Russell latches onto. He says, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom come in his glory. And each of the three synoptics says virtually the same thing. It's worded slightly differently because we're going from the original Aramaic that Jesus would have spoken, and we're rendering it to all three of the synoptic, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are rendering it into Greek, the Koine Greek of that age. So as you see all the three accounts, they're virtually identical, and it's clearly that Jesus did say this in Aramaic, and the thrust of his prophecy is clear. But what Bertrand Russell says is, no, that prophecy flopped, it failed, it crashed and burned. And you ask, well, how was that? He says, because Jesus never came back in the life of his disciples. He is still not come back, and if he was the triumphant king, as he said, and if some of his disciples would not die until they saw the kingdom come with power, then he failed. And there's a similar prophecy, you know, that is sometimes discerned in the Olivet Discourse, the week that Jesus was crucified. I can't get into that one, but let me just focus on this. And Bertrand Russell says, gotcha. Well, that's where the cross-examination comes in. Because I would put Bertrand Russell on the witness stand and say, dear philosopher Russell, have you read the following verses, the next 10 verses that follow that prophecy? Well, what does that have to do with it? Well, let's read them together. And then I would go to Matthew, and then to Mark, and then to Luke. And I would read those verses that say, 8 days later, Jesus took three of his disciples, Peter, James, and John, and went to a high mountain and was basically turned like into a brilliant sunrise, or, you know, the sun, as it were, was showing its power out of his clothing and out of his body. It was just beaming this huge amount of light from him. And as they saw him transfigured, they were seeing with, you know, Elijah and Moses there standing with him, a picture of a raptured Christian, a resurrected Christian, and three Christians in their physical bodies. And that is a microcosm of the coming kingdom. Well, we will have raptured saints and resurrected saints and saints in their physical bodies. So he's picturing through the transfiguration this powerful coming moment, the coming period of time, I should say. And that's when the world, not just a few disciples, but the whole world will see the kingdom. And that preview, that sneak preview that was given to those three disciples is what Jesus was predicting, and not that they would live all the way until the time when his kingdom was literally established. And so I think that the prediction and the fulfillment fit perfectly. And so Bertrand Russell's point, his supposed gotcha point, falls apart and dissolves in under close analysis. So I think that one of the things that, if I can switch gears and just go into biology and astronomy and physics for a moment, is a lot of people have said, oh, this universe is so poorly designed. Well, I mean, look at the danger that we see in our galaxy with black holes and all these kind of heavy-duty radiation zones where it's dangerous to get near a pulsar or an X-ray neutron star, or, you know, XYZ, any kind of phenomenon that is really, really, you know, hostile to life, has been pointed to as an example of poor design. Well, we could say, well, you know, in an engine, there are hot parts of the engine that if you touch them, you would get burned. Does that mean that the engine is poorly designed? No. There is a covering, there is a hood, or as they call it, I think in England, a bonnet, that latches down over that engine and keeps us from, as it were, sitting on the engine, getting burns to our body. I mean, we could point to zillions of examples of parts of larger machines that if you actually had contact with them, yes, of course, they could do harm, but the machine is brilliantly designed. It's a manifestation of exquisite, ingenious intelligence. God is the ultimate, I like to use the word mastermind, this whole, you know, ingenious enterprise. Sometimes it's used with bad people, but I see God as the perfect, the morally spectacular, but also brilliantly ingenious mastermind of the creation of the universe, the creation of the earth, the creation of all biological species, and the creation of mankind, the pinnacle of those species that can actually have a personal relationship with God that goes on forever and ever. Wow. Now, that's mastermind of the highest order. And so when Neil deGrasse Tyson, the very popular speaking physics astronomy expert who actually worked with the Hayden Planetarium, New York City, for many years, I'm not sure if he's still there, but he is one of the most popular lecturers. I enjoy listening to him. But when he turns and veers into attacks on creation or on the design of the cosmos, he gets downright silly. And I took liberty in chapter 11 of my book, Darwin Strikes Back. Many physics and astronomy figures have actually said wonderful things in a positive sense about the design of the universe. The exception of that happens to be Neil deGrasse Tyson, who has written in his very interesting book, Death by a Black Hole. Death by a Black Hole is a very, very entertaining essay. It's the, I think, opening essay to the book entitled Death by Black Hole. But in that book, he has one essay that really rips into the idea of the created cosmos. And he argues mankind should have really had quite an alteration. Our eyes should have been able to pick up infrared and ultraviolet radiation. So the fact that we only have the visible light spectrum means we're poorly designed eyes. We should have had gills and gill slits embedded in our cheeks so that we could dive and just breathe in water like fish. That's interesting. Let me go ahead and create a man with gill slits. He lashes out against creation and he's trying to use poor design, what's called dysteleology. Well, the good news is that his argument is laughable. It's weak. It's pathetic. It's hardly even worthy of being answered to. But what I did in my chapter, I gave five reasons, not one, not two, but five reasons why Neil deGrasse Tyson's argument is juicy. It's ready for the cross-examination. So in a sense, Neil deGrasse Tyson's writings on the topic of poor design, and again, we use this word dysteleology, so D-Y-S means bad, like dysfunctional, something that's non-functional. But dysteleology is one of the great perennial attack machines that is rolled out, dusted off by Darwinian opponents of creation. And dysteleology has this kind of checkered but rather interesting history of being used again and again and again, even though their arguments have been refuted and I think just basically obliterated by the truth and by the sheer logic that they do not see in good design. So, for one thing, I pointed out that intelligent design restricts itself to not necessarily identifying a theologically God-level figure, and that's one both advantage and disadvantage of intelligent design, and that is we say that design is design, whether you like it or not, and we can criticize design all day long, but you know the fact that we do not particularly care for a particular kind of feature in a design does not mean that it wasn't produced by an intelligence. That's sheer non sequitur. That is, it doesn't follow. A does not follow upon A. That is, in other words, B does not come from A. And so if your B is that this is not designed, that does not follow from A. I do not like this particular design feature. And, of course, design features are a whole matter of trade-offs. In other words, you balance the strength of the air conditioning system for a particular house or building, if it's a business building. If you have lots of windows, you must get a bigger air conditioning system because more light and therefore more heat is coming into the building. But if you make your windows smaller, you may have to purchase more light bulbs, but your air conditioning unit doesn't have to be as large, especially if you're in Florida. And I use simple examples like this as the fact that factor A and B and C and D and so on all the way through Z, all those factors have to be balanced out against one another in the totality of the complete design. And so to come in as a critic is very tricky. You know, good luck with that, because the one who's designed the system may have like five answers for every criticism that you have. And if I could just bring out, Nick, I think that you've heard of pseudogenes. There's an attack made on Christianity through pseudogenes. Let me just kind of ask you if you are keeping up with the literature on that. But you've heard about genes that mimic real genes, but they supposedly have a glitch or an error in them?
Yes.
So I'm going to venture for just a few minutes. I think we have a couple minutes left. But there is an attack that was leveled at a trial held in Pennsylvania just about 15 years ago. The decision came out in 2005, in which the district court, federal level judge, had basically ruled that not only could the Dover school system in Pennsylvania not include a mention of intelligent design in its requirements for teachers and principals, but they ruled Judge Jones actually went beyond that and ruled that intelligent design isn't even a science. It is just a religious concept, which was totally illegitimate. And the meandering, the moseying, as it were, into the topic of this whether intelligent design is science or just sheer philosophy or something else was totally inappropriate for a guy who had zero training in science or the philosophy of science. But anyway, Judge Jones, spouted off on that topic, and the result is a 15-year celebration party from the Darwin side. Well, the funny thing is that Judge Jones was using the globin gene example. One professor came in and testified. His name is Ken Miller. He's from Brown University in Rhode Island. But he came in and testified that trial that there is no evidence of good design in our bodies. We evolved by sheer Darwinian evolution. And the proof is the globin gene. Well, what's the globin gene? You've heard of hemoglobin. It's very important for blood functioning. Well, one of the six genes that is included in this cluster that is actually embedded in the DNA of all animals that have hemoglobin, that have our kind of blood, have this, not all of them have this same pseudogene, but there are examples that we can find three different species among the primates that have the same false gene. In other words, it's a gene that doesn't have all the letters in it, and it has the same pattern of a what's called a stop codon. And it's like putting a period at the end of a sentence, but you move up that period to maybe five words before the end of the sentence, put the period there, and then chop off the rest of the sentence. That's what this pseudogene looks like. It looks like the end was cut off and the period was moved up and put at the end of an incomplete sentence. So this beta globin gene, he said, this is proof because it has no function. And therefore, what would a creator do by inserting into these three, the human, the chimp, and this other primate species, why would the creator ever put those three erroneous genes in those three species separately, which it has no function? And the point is that this answer seemed like a slam dunk that Christians and other people who follow intelligent design basically have been saying, not so fast. We don't know anything in particular about that gene that it might or might not have a function. Well, now scientists have come out and have published in peer-reviewed literature that the beta-globin pseudogene is not junk. If anything, it is an exquisitely designed tool. It's basically an explanatory answer. It is the cross-examination. The answer comes from science in this case. And as scientists themselves have done deeper research, they've seen a preservation of the precise spelling of that gene over time, which means it is functional. It's being used as a regulator. It's being used as a controlling device on the total structure of those other globin genes to basically time everything that's happening in the functioning of our blood production. So I'm just so thankful that science, again, has come to the rescue, and the cross-examination is successful. And Mike and Ken Miller's testimony is now being thrown out of court, virtually speaking. So the ultimate cross that we should examine, of course, is the cross of Christ, on which our sins were paid for, and the one who rose from the dead offers eternal life and plenty of evidence to go with it.
Yes, make sure to cross-examine what you hear. That is what we're told in Scripture. And make sure to check out our webinar series that is going to be coming out March 18th at noon Eastern Time. We will be interviewing none other than the world-renowned apologist, Dr. John Lennox. You'll find a link on apologetics.org that's going to be March 18th, so check that out. And on that note, if you look at our recent podcast just a couple of months ago, we had done an interview with Dr. John Lennox and Kevin Sorbo on their new movie, Against the Tide, which you can now view. If you have any questions or comments, please send us an email at information@apologetics.org. That's information@apologetics.org. And we'll see you back here next week. Thank you for listening to The Universe Next Door.
You've been listening to The Universe Next Door with Dr. Tom Woodward, sponsored by the C.S. Lewis Society and Trinity College of Florida, and supported through the gifts of listeners just like you. To gather resources, continue the conversation, and support The Universe Next Door with your financial gifts, go to apologetics.org. That's apologetics.org. And join us again next time as we continue to seek the truth about life, faith, and worldview in The Universe Next Door.